may be seated. Our next case this morning is 2019-84, Michael Pivranka et al. Versus Barbara Sears, Director of the Ohio Department of Medicaid, for the appellant, Mr. Hendershot.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, in this nine-figure class action, the 8th District made a host of errors, both of subject matter jurisdiction as well as in applying Civil Rule 23. But before detailing those, I think it's worth a step back for the big picture. The big picture here is the very complaint that launched this class action has since been solved legislatively and administratively. And because the Common Pleas judge stayed the order certifying the class, those who are potentially members of it have been working with the department to get back money if they did, in fact, overpay the department to unwind these double recoveries. But even so, there are a host of errors here that should lead to reversal. And let me break those down first as to subject matter jurisdiction and then as to Rule 23. Two different statutes block the Common Pleas Court subject matter jurisdiction here. The first is the statute that I mentioned that has been solving the problem practically since the class, since the class has been certified. That statute says that the sole remedy for Medicaid recipients who believe that they have overpaid the Department of Medicaid during an unwinding of double recovery, and let's step back and understand why there are double recoveries here. So an Ohioan is injured, say in a car accident, that's the most common situation. They're Medicaid eligible, so the department pays for some of the medical expenses. Then that person recovers in a tort settlement or a tort judgment, also for the medical expenses. Under federal law, the department must unwind that double recovery. But as the U.S. Supreme Court made clear in 2013, sometimes that's messy. Sometimes in unwinding that, the unwinding takes from a non-medical part of the settlement or judgment. So that's what the statute is all about, is solving that problem administratively.
Counsel, the statute wasn't enacted until 2015. So how do we look at that in relation to when the suit was filed? Did the court have jurisdiction but then lost jurisdiction?
Well, because we think there are two bases for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. One, the Court of Claims statute, that of course predated it. But yes, as to the first, I think where this case should start and end, this statute that we've called the Collection Remedy Statute, that was passed after this and another class action were started. But that doesn't make a difference. Changes of jurisdiction operate forward-looking and prospectively, and so that change of where the remedy takes place, it doesn't change at all to a penny the recovery that a recipient would get in Common Pleas Court versus in the administrative remedy. But yes, that statute that we're talking about was passed in 2015. This class action was started in 2013. But the key language of that statute, this is in subsection P of the statute, says that the sole remedy for a Medicaid recipient that believes that in unwinding that double recovery, there had been an overcollection from that person's judgment or settlement, the sole remedy is this administrative process. That includes an appeal all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. But that sole remedy language shows that Common Pleas Courts do not have jurisdiction, do not have subject matter jurisdiction to resolve that same complaint. And that way, it makes it like the exclusive remedy provisions, say, in workers' compensation, state employment relations, environmental permitting. All areas that I've just mentioned are instances where this court has used its extraordinary writ power and prohibition to say a Common Pleas Court cannot adjudicate this workers' compensation claim, this state employment relations claim, this environmental permitting claim. So here, we're not even seeking a writ. We're just saying on de novo review, on appeal, this lack of subject matter jurisdiction should be enforced, and that, of course, takes the rug out from underneath the class certification.
Counsel, your friends on the other side point to Herrick and say, you know, with a class, in that case it was 40,000, but here, potentially a very large class, it's just a declaratory judgment action, and it's better to have it as a class action.
Well, I'd make several points about that. First, Herrick, a 75 case, has been superseded, really, by Bozarth. We point this out in our brief. That is a later case dealing with exclusive provisions dealing with environmental permitting. And what the court said there to distinguish Herrick is, in Herrick, the administrative process was non-exclusive. in Bozarth, which dealt with environmental permitting. It was exclusive. I recently cited that case in Winter in 2017, again, making the point that that's an area of exclusive administrative jurisdiction. The sole remedy language, coupled with a part of the statute that says this remedy extends back further than any conceivable statute of limitations. It looked back 8 years, back to 2007 when it was passed, to capture anyone who believed they may have overpaid or had the department overcollect from them. So that's why Herrick is not a good guide here. Instead, Bozarth, and then a companion case to Bozarth a few months later, the Warren Molded Plastics case, actually dealt with a claim that the environmental permitting action was unconstitutional. And so the pair of those cases show that when there is an exclusive provision, an exclusive remedial provision, an exclusive administrative provision to solve the problem, that ousts the Common Pleas Court of Jurisdiction. That's just the General Assembly making the very judgment that the court did make in Herrick because there wasn't an explicit statute in place. But the General Assembly, certainly under Article 4, Section 4, has the power to decide when the Common Pleas Court has jurisdiction and when it doesn't. And so whether that is more or less convenient is really a legislative judgment. But here, of course,
speaking of convenience, which entity has jurisdiction, the Court of Claims or the administrative agency?
We would say here, Your Honor, the administrative agency. In terms of the order of operations of these two subject matter jurisdiction statutes, if you did those in the reverse order and looked at the Court of Claims question first and agreed with us that the Court of Claims would have jurisdiction if you pretended that this collection remedy statute didn't exist, then you would end up in the Court of Claims, and then we would file a motion saying it belongs in the administrative process. So that, in the order of operations, should come first.
So it doesn't belong in the Court of Claims?
No. I'd say it belongs in the Court of Claims.
So you're not arguing subject matter jurisdiction belongs in the Court of Claims?
Well, we're arguing that in the alternative, Your Honor. There's two distinct statutes that bar the Common Pleas Court here from having subject matter jurisdiction. First and foremost is this statute that says the sole remedy is with this administrative process. If for some reason you don't find that persuasive, you reject that argument, then you would look at the Court of Claims statute and say, all right, it belongs in court. Which court? Well, it belongs in the Court of Claims because this suit does not seek specifically identifiable funds in the possession of the Department of Medicaid. So that's only a step you reach if you disagree with the point that we have raised about the subject matter jurisdiction being in the agency because of the sole remedy language that looks back to 2007 that makes it an exclusive remedial provision like workers' compensation, like state employment relations, like environmental permitting.
And does the 2007 retroactivity take care of the members of the class?
It is not completely coextensive with the class, Your Honor, because the class looked back 6 years, claiming there was a six-year statute of limitations.
From 2013 back.
Exactly. So it doesn't quite overlap. The statute reaches back to September 29th of 2007. The class, when it was filed in April of 2013, looked back 6 years. The reason, we think that doesn't matter for two reasons. Number one, there's not a solid argument here for a six-year statute of limitations. Under SOG v. ZERS, that should be a four-year statute of limitations. And number two, the eight-year look back from the 2015 statute, so from 2015 back to 2007, September 29 back to September 29, captures the moment in 2007 when this statute that the class says is preempted by federal law was enacted. So the version, the old statute that predated 2015, went into effect in September of 2015. So for both those reasons, that couple of month lack of overlap should not matter in our view, and that everyone who could have been harmed by the old statute, who has a claim that they were harmed by the old statute, is covered by this administrative process. We think that's an exclusive administrative process. It ousts the Common Pleas Court of Jurisdiction.
How practically could they have raised their argument, which is essentially it's unconstitutional, in the administrative process?
2 points about that, Your Honor. Their claim of unconstitutionality under federal law is a claim of preemption. And so we think that administrative agency, number one, can do the choice of law analysis as to what law governs the claim. It would be no different than a Board of Tax Appeals saying, because of dormant commerce clause principles, the taxation law doesn't govern this transaction. But even if you don't think that is proper for the administrative agency, then you can raise that preemption argument on appeal. There's an appeal into the Common Pleas Court and then all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, the case that set this ship sail, it was a U.S. Supreme Court case that made its way up from North Carolina all the way through. It was a single person, not a class action. And so that issue of preemption of the North Carolina statute was raised in the North Carolina trial courts, and it worked its way. That started in federal court. That started in the federal district court and worked its way all the way up. So that, we think, is where the case should begin and end. There's also, as we've been discussing, a subject matter jurisdiction problem with the Court of Claims.
Well, let me ask you about that. Have you ever raised that before? Was that raised before you got to this court?
It was not, but as subject matter jurisdiction, I think it's our obligation to raise that.
Did the state consent to being sued in common pleas court by not objecting to it?
No, we don't think that the state can consent to subject matter jurisdiction when it is lacking. And of course, the main subject matter jurisdiction argument that we're advancing here, of course, is a statute that was passed while this case was going on. Let me, before I invade any more of the rebuttal time, then just make these three points. I haven't talked about the class action, the Rule 23 application at all. And there, I would note that the 8th District, if you can look at paragraphs 50 and 51 of its opinion, it acted directly contrary to what this court has repeatedly and emphatically said about class actions. The 8th District said it could not look at the merits at all. This court has said in Stamkos, in Cullen, in Felix, that you must answer a merits question if it also answers a Rule 23 question, and that is true here. The 8th District said at paragraph 51 that it would employ a presumption in favor of certifying a class. This court and many others have said exactly the opposite. And then back to the big picture for a moment. This certified class impedes the department's federal law obligation to unwind double recoveries, to better be a steward of the funds it administers for Ohio's needy. And finally, the class is not even good for classes like this itself because it allows certification even when there is a superior administrative process that is quicker and cheaper than litigation to solve the exact same problem.
What about the argument that there are many people that are involved in this whole process and will be involved in the unwinding, et cetera, that are ill-suited to present their cases, even in an administrative setting?
We always make two points about that. The process certainly is as user-friendly as possible. You could trigger the hearing process online. You could participate in this hearing process on paper or through a Skype-type procedure. This is itself not on the record. This is the way the process plays out. And remember that everyone that is potentially a member of the class here had a settlement or judgment with another tortfeasor, so they had a lawyer there. In fact, the notice that went out from the department at the very bottom, this is supplement page 252, says, if you have questions about this, at least first reach out to the lawyer that was involved in that third party. Come back to my car accident example. Someone represented these folks in that action against the other driver, for example. Your Honor, I would ask
that. There's no obligation for that lawyer to be involved.
That's right, Your Honor. There's not an obligation.
And if the lawyer's out of business, has passed away, has moved on, then what?
Well, sure. That's part of the legislative judgment that this is a better mechanism than the class action for solving this problem. The notices went out to all the folks for this 8-year period, and it's a very user-friendly process, and it is. Because there was a stay of the class action, almost all those administrative actions have been resolved since then. And also, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Perotti with Dworkin and Bernstein. I want to start out by apologizing to everybody on the panel for not timely filing our brief. That was totally our fault. And I take responsibility for it. And I would like to sincerely thank the panel, and especially my friends at the Attorney General's office, for not opposing allowing us to have oral argument. I sat down and I read this whole new statute. You have to read the whole thing. Because when you read it, the question here, they're talking about L1 and L2. L's not the issue here. P is the issue. P deals with the sole remedy language. And the only question before this court on that issue is whether P is retroactive. P is not retroactive because it does not say it's retroactive. And according to 1.48 of the Ohio Revised Code and this court's seminal decision in Van Fossen, retroactivity has a two-part test. The first part of the test is you look to see whether the General Assembly expressed a clear intention in the language of the statute to make the provision, in this case, the provision that says you shall have a sole remedy in this agency, whether there's a clear intent to make that retroactive. There is nothing in P that says it's retroactive whatsoever. So knowing that, they turn to L. Well, L is two parts. L is part one. Part one deals with situations that occur after the effective date of the statute, because the government is still collecting this money. And they decided we're going to deal with woes, we're going to create a proper system, and we're going to address it going forward. Our class members are not in that group, so I won't opine on whether that system is constitutional. Because as the chief mentioned, there are a number of questions about how do you do this, and I think that somebody said, what about people who are ill? The chief justice said, what about people who are ill-suited even for an administrative setting? And the defendant said, well, the process is easy. And I wrote down, really? Where's the records? This is 15 years later. Where are these people possibly today going to get the records to prove, they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the government was wrong? Well, the other thing that we're missing is that the government can't collect money from the citizen without a statute. The men in black can't show up at your door with their sunglasses and say, we're from the tax department, you have to pay $1,000. You say, okay, on what authority? There must be a statutory authority. And Ohio law is clear that when a statute is stricken as unconstitutional, as this one is, and they concede at page 5 of their brief that their statute is unconstitutional, there is no authority for them to have collected this money. Therefore, when they got to 2015, they had no authority to have collected the money in the first place, and therefore our lawsuit was filed. So again, you have a suit filed. The case is here on the defendant's claim.
Why not file in the Court of Claims?
The Court of Claims does not have jurisdiction over this case. Let me give you a very, very, very interesting fact. There was a case, and again, we have to talk about, hoisted on their own petard, or sometimes you use the word judicial estoppel. There was a case called Dunlap and another case called Cullinan. Those were child support cases. The father had child support overcollected from him. The government then sent the money to the feds and some to the custodial spouse. The father sued, not for a class, just for himself, in the Court of Claims. And he said, I'm in the Court of Claims because the Court of Claims has jurisdiction over legal claims. Not, they don't have jurisdiction over equitable ones. Only the common pleas court does. But this is a legal claim because you gave the money away. Locus of the money that you talked about, Your Honor, in Sereno. You gave the money away. And the Court of Claims said, no, 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 no. This is an equitable proceeding. And the Attorney General said, this is not a proceeding for the Court of Claims. This is a proceeding for the Common Pleas Court. And I will read you, and you can take notice of the filings in your own court. I will read you page 1 of their brief opposing jurisdiction. Kalinin says that he needs review to clarify Santos, but his proposition of law will muddle the plain rule of Santos. We agree with that. Santos is very clear. Kalinin would have the court exempt a particular type of restitution from the operation of Santos and require the courts to try to divine whether the state still holds particular funds in order to determine jurisdiction. Here comes the most important wording. But Santos applies regardless of whether the funds are still held by the state or not, and therefore there is no reason to accept review of this matter. Now, I don't think that the Attorney General can come to this court today and say the opposite of what it said in writing in Kalinin and in the Dunlap case. So we have a situation where, and I want to address this because Your Honor asked in your concurrence, which was agreed to by Justice Kennedy and Justice French in the C case, I forget the name of it, it was the one with the broken windshields, and we were talking about what does Santos mean? And the majority says this can't be in the court, in the common pleas court, it's got to be in the court of claims. And the dissent, I think it was maybe Your Honor, said, no, it should be here. And you said, you know, Santos says one thing, but we're getting two different rules. We need some clarity. And you said, maybe we should look at the locus of the funds. And we agree. The key in that case is if you look at the history and you look at something called Ohio Hospital Association, there are two situations in which equitable jurisdiction arises to allow the Court of Claims to entertain a suit against the government. The first situation is if the government collects money from a plaintiff pursuant to a law later declared invalid, or if the government keeps money that it owes to the plaintiff under a particular statute and does so pursuant to a law that's later declared invalid, then the plaintiff sues for those monies. That suit is properly brought in the Court of Common Pleas. And the reason is because, as Santos said, equity jurisdiction lies over monies which are either collected, the first situation, or retained, the second situation. And what happens, the subsequent disposition of those monies, as the AG correctly said, is completely irrelevant to subject matter jurisdiction. What that addresses is the relief granted in unjust enrichment, which is a proceeding in equity. So when you look at the record and the government here says, for example, well, we gave some of this money to the feds, that doesn't affect this, the court system's jurisdiction.
Well, hasn't the United States Supreme Court at least said that you have to have both an equitable claim and an equitable remedy?
We do. We have both of these. And I would point you, Your Honor, to the case that you cited in your concurrence in Sereno, and that was the Montanile case. And again, if you look at Montanile, if you look at Sereno, in Sereno, what happened? Again, as you said, follow the money. In Sereno, the state of Ohio paid money to a bank. And it was money that was owed to Justice Donnelly as a citizen for some particular program. The bank then took $5 out and then gave you the rest. You then sue the BWC for the $5. Well, I agree with this court, and I disagree with my friend Mr. Bashine, that was not a proceeding in equity. Because that money never, ever was being held by the government. The government didn't take any money from a citizen, all right? The citizen didn't pay any money to the government that it's trying to get back. In Montanile got money from the tortfeasor, number two. He then spent all the money. Number three, the pension plan sued Montanile for the money that it paid to the hospital. Again, there was no situation in which the plaintiff was suing an entity that either had money that the plaintiff had given them or was holding money that it owed to the plaintiff. The only situations that are like that, likewise in my case, measles or Zalesnik. In measles, we had a contract. And this court says you can't sue in equity when you have to determine the contours of the right by looking at the language of the contract. Here, we're not talking about a contract, we're talking about a statute. They took the money pursuant to a statute. The statute was a bogus statute, so they can't keep the money under Holoton, under Santos, under a number of other cases. The only cases in which the rule applies are Santos, the plaintiff gets money from tortfeasors, number two, the BWC sues plaintiff for the money. Number three, the plaintiff gives the money to the BWC, and then the plaintiff sues the BWC and says, give me my money back. Now, it doesn't matter what the retains also can mean and should mean that the government didn't give the money back to the person it took it from. Because we can't supervise. They wouldn't ask. I don't think the state asks, and we certainly don't ask you to expect the courts to supervise each agency to see, okay, what'd you do with Perotti's dollar? It's a different, and the Great West case talks about this, the idea of in specie. In specie is if you take a bike and the bike's now gone, then you probably can't get equity. But money is fungible. So if the government takes $5, you can get $5 back whether it's that same dollar bill or different ones. And that's what Santos means. And in Santos, that happened. And guess what? It happened here in Pavanka. Exact same situation. Pavanka gets money from a tortfeasor. The BWC sues plaintiff for that tort money. Pavanka pays the money to the BWC. and then plaintiff sues the BWC and says, or this is this case the state, the Medicaid department, and says, give me my money back. All of those meet all of the tests and all of the policy reasons behind why Santos was decided the way it was, and why, recognizing the Ohio Hospital Association, in which people did not give money to the government. In Ohio Hospital, the government owed money to Ohio Hospital Association, but it said, we're not giving it to you because of this statute, and then this court said, that statute's unconstitutional. And Ohio Hospital then sued, and this court said, that's a proceeding in equity. It belongs in the Common Pleas Court. And so, again, the controlling issue here is Section P. Is Section P retroactive? And if you look at Section L, which deals with the hearing, L1 says you must take a hearing going forward. Doesn't affect my clients. L2 says you may ask for a hearing. The General Assembly doesn't pass statutes that it intends to be unconstitutional. The General Assembly uses words for a reason, and it distinguishes between words for a reason. And in the two adjoining paragraphs, in one it said shall, and the other it said may, and they did it for a reason. Because they couldn't say shall in number two, because they couldn't say, you people from 2007, you shall ask for a hearing, because they weren't making it retroactive. And if they did, do you know what it would have done? It would have raised a real, real thorny question. It would have raised the question of whether the legislature has the power to strip a court already vested in jurisdiction over a pending action. This court does not address constitutional questions when it doesn't need to, and here it doesn't need to because P does not indicate that it's retroactive. And again, how do you know if something is retroactive? Does it say so? And if a And I will close unless you...
Counsel, is this process, this administrative simplified process that the appellants have described, is that being currently used?
It is no longer available for anyone in this class. It's over. It was over 2 years and 3 months ago because you only had 6 months to do it. It's gone. I don't know whether they're using it for current people. Again, I don't represent those people. I only represent people whose money was taken between, the class they concede. The class is 2007, April 5th through April 6th of 2013. There is no process for those people. And if they indicate there is, then...
They had a six-month window?
They had some six-month window, apparently. And they apparently, they said, and again, with due respect, the last thing I will say before I finish up with this one point is, all of this stuff deals with merits issues that are not in this record. The trial judge hasn't even looked at any of this.
Why hasn't the trial judge looked at any of this on the merits?
Because the trial judge certified the class, and then immediately they took an appeal. And the trial judge did not get to the merits because you don't get to the merits before you certify a class, because if you do, you have a problem of one-way intervention. You certify the class, and then you decide the merits, so it applies to everybody, which this would happen. The lower court's ruling of you either get all your money or you don't is going to apply to everybody in the class. But the thing that I want to mention is that when the General Assembly wants to make a statute retroactive, especially intends it to strip a court of jurisdiction, it knows how to do it. And Justice French was on the panel in Carter versus Carter in the 10th District, in which they talked about exactly what kind of words you look for. You look for words in that case such as this section applies to pending actions, including appeals filed before the effective date of this act. Look at Section P and find any kind of language that even comes close to that. You won't. There's no retroactivity. The lower court did not err. Thank you.
Mr. Hendershot, talk to me about retroactivity.
Yes, Your Honor. So retroactivity, the statute here is not retroactive at all. It's forward-looking because changes in procedure and changes in jurisdiction are forward-looking. I'll give you a couple of examples. This court held in Longbottom versus Mercy Hospital that changes to the prejudgment interest statute, both how you go about it and what kind of damages they're available for, was prospective. This court held in Atkinson versus Anchor Packing that a change for pending cases, 40,000 asbestos cases pending in Cuyahoga County, there was a new procedure implemented on the front end of those, the administrative dismissal.
What about the group or the class here?
Right, the class here, this is just a change in location of where the remedy will take place. Take a look at Landgraf versus USI. It's a case we cite in our brief from the US Supreme Court. It collects multiple cases from the US Supreme Court dealing with this exact problem. It cites one case where the change in jurisdiction from one court to another was made while the case was pending certiorari. This is not a retroactive statute. A change in where and how you decide a question is a forward-looking.
Okay, so, but your premise, from what I understand, is take them out of the class, and these are all individuals who have access to this sole remedy statute, which allows them then to process their appeal or their action with the administrative agency. Is that correct?
That's largely correct, Your Honor. Just one thing I would note, it didn't take them out of the class when the statute was passed long before the class was certified. And the statute is, of course, one reason for
Rule 23. Well, you would dissolve the class, correct? There would no longer be a need for a class because there's no action in the Common Pleas Court, so therefore their only recourse is the administrative agency or the administrative process that you've described.
Yes, that's right. The administrative process is their remedy.
There was reference to a six-month window, and if they did not take advantage of it, they have no recourse here.
Yes, there's a six-month window, so all people that potentially overpaid were given notice. This is the notice on page 252 of the supplement that says you have 6 months to, if you think you've overpaid, because most members of this class, take a look at Ms. Rios's case here. She was in a car accident. There's a jury interrogatory that's quite explicit that there was $2,200 of medical bills that the jury awarded her. The department said, to avoid double recovery, you owe us $700. Tons of members of the class would not have actually taken advantage of this process because there was no plausible claim they overpaid the department. For those that did, around $2,200, they took advantage of this process. This is not in the record because it's ongoing. There's about 200 of those left from that original batch that said, we'd like to take advantage of this process. And so that process is nearing an end now, but it is resolving the very basis for this class action.
Any response on the Court of Claims issue?
Sure, a lot to say there, Your Honor. So, number one, the statements that were made opposing jurisdiction in 2012, I believe, pre-Sereno, just opposing jurisdiction is certainly not something that should prevent us from, especially in light of the Sereno opinions, advancing the correct theory of Court of Claims jurisdiction, which does deal with specifically identifiable funds in the possession of the department. That was said before Santos, in Drain versus Casadar, in Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, cases for unjust enrichment, cases for conversion, trying to collect back, get money that the government had collected to get it back. Both of those cases are ones this court sent to the Court of Claims. But of course, we don't think that you get there at all because this sole remedy language, which is not retroactive, it's a change in jurisdiction. It is forward-looking, like Longbottom, like Atkinson, like Denicola versus Providence Hospital, like Landgraf. All those cases show why this is a forward-looking statute. One question,
so, counsel, one other point before you move on from there. You heard Mr. Perotti's argument that if you look at a case like the Carter versus Carter out of the 10th District, that we need to look at specific language. We need to look for specific language before we will presume that the General Assembly meant their action to apply to a pending case. How do you respond to that?
Sure. 2 points, Your Honor. That's when you have a problem of retroactivity. But this is not a problem of retroactivity. It is forward-looking to change procedure, to change jurisdiction. But if you wanted to look for evidence, opening up a procedure back to 2007 before any conceivable statute of limitations certainly is a backward-looking if you thought you had to look for evidence of backward-looking intent. Your Honor, my friend asked about, this process is hard. Where are the records to do this? Well, 90% of those who requested hearing have been completed. Cases like Ms. Rios's or Mr. Pavanka's, the records are there because they worked with an attorney in a jury trial in Ms. Rios' case, in a settlement with the department in Mr. Pavanka's case. The records are there to decide whether or not those folks are entitled to collect. And if we look at those two, both Rios and Pavanka, it's just one of many Rule 23 problems with the class, and I won't go through all of those as I'm here in rebuttal. They are atypical of the class because, as we talked about with Ms. Rios, the department asked her to return $700. She received far more than that in medical expenses on a jury interrogatory. There's no question about what she received. Mr. Pavanka settled the exact claim he's trying to litigate on behalf of the class here. But first and foremost, the 8th District, look at paragraphs 50 and 51 of what it did. Its decision to say we can't touch the merits at all, its decision saying there's a presumption in favor of certifying a class are both directly contrary to Stamco, to Cullen, to Felix, and this court's repeated insistence on how to conduct Rule 23 inquiries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.